hear from you first.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Lee Radofsky. I'm the Solicitor General of Arkansas, and I represent the Arkansas Department of Human Services. I'll be reserving 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Well, you'll have to watch the clock. It won't stop automatically.
Yes, Your Honor.
Sit down as you wish.
In a series of interlocking statutes governing the Medicaid program, Congress has set forth more than 50 types of misconduct for which a state Department of Human Services may decide a Medicaid provider is no longer qualified to participate in the Medicaid program. The ultimate issue in this appeal is what is the proper forum and who is the proper party to challenge such a decision. Congress expressly and explicitly provided two ways for such a challenge to occur. First, a provider appeal. Under 42 U.S.C. 1320A-7, subsection F, a state Department of Human Services must allow the provider to appeal a state DHS determination that a provider is no longer qualified. We must provide an opportunity for an administrative appeal and then an appeal of that decision to the state courts. Second, Congress has expressly and explicitly provided federal Department of Human Services oversight. Under 42 U.S.C. 1396C, Congress gave the federal DHS the ability, after consultation and cooperation, to withhold Medicaid funding from a state if it believes the state has erroneously disqualified a Medicaid provider and is out of compliance with its Medicaid plan. The district court's decision below, however, erroneously created a third way to challenge this decision. It allows a Medicaid patient to collaterally challenge the decision that a Medicaid provider has acted in a way that renders it unqualified to be in the Medicaid program. This type of collateral attack doesn't make any sense. Unlike a provider itself or the federal DHS, lay patients lack the knowledge and facts to decide whether a particular piece of misconduct has rendered a medical provider unqualified for the Medicaid program. They lack the medical expertise to judge whether that misconduct leaves them unqualified. They have the wrong incentives. Their incentives are to go to the provider they want to go to, not necessarily to make sure that that provider has done nothing that disqualifies it from the Medicaid program. And this creates a significant amount of misincentives. For example, take this very case. In this case, Planned Parenthood intentionally chose to forego an appeal, an administrative appeal, and an appeal to the state courts. Instead, and they admit this, they recruited a couple of patients so they could end up in federal court challenging the qualification decision. That is clearly the wrong way, given what Congress has set the system up to be. The reason the district court erred is because it misinterpreted a provision of the Medicaid Act and misunderstood the right that it confers on Medicaid patients. And as this court knows, I'm talking about 42 U.S.C. 1396AA23. The Supreme Court has specifically addressed this provision in a due process case, but they've specifically addressed what this provision means in O'Bannon v. Towne Center Nursing Home. The Supreme Court has said that this provision gives patients a right to choose among qualified providers, but not to challenge a particular state's particular qualification decision. In fact, it faulted the Court of Appeals in that case for failing to give proper weight to the contours of the right. O'Bannon is correct and applicable in this case. Opposing counsel from Planned Parenthood argues that O'Bannon shouldn't really matter to this court because it's a due process case. But that's a misunderstanding of O'Bannon. The logic of O'Bannon is clear. The reason there was no due process right in O'Bannon is because what right the statute did or did not confer. There, the statute conferred a right to choose among a range of providers, but not to have a particular provider deemed qualified or to challenge a particular provider being deemed unqualified. And if you need more than that, Blessing and Gonzaga are very clear. They teach us that, especially in a spending statute, only a clear and unmistakable language by Congress will create a personal federal right. The logic of that is that we need to strictly construe whatever statute we're looking at to ensure that it actually gives the right that we're looking at. Here, if Congress had wanted to give patients a right to challenge a state DHS qualification decision, it would have been much more clear. It would have said a plan must provide that patients can challenge the DHS's qualification or termination decision. But that's not what Congress did. 42 U.S.C. 1396 AA23 is really an anti-steering provision. And I would particularly point this court to the Harris case. Judge Sutton's understanding in the Harris case in the Sixth Circuit is exactly right. That case was about incontinence products, and more specifically for our purposes, it was about a state requiring that all Medicaid patients get incontinence products from a single supplier. It was a single supplier contract. And what Judge Sutton said is that is particularly the right that 1396 AA23 was saying you couldn't do. You couldn't steer patients to one particular or maybe 10 particular providers. You had to provide more of a range of options than that. In fact, Judge Sutton went on and said, whether a state plan provides an individual with the choice specified in the provision is likely to be readily apparent. And the reason it's likely to be readily apparent is it's really an easy question of whether you're steering a Medicaid patient to one particular place or you're steering them to, let's say, 10 providers out of 1,000, or whether you're giving them a large range of choices. This is the same principle in Chisholm, which is another case we cite in our brief out of the Eastern District of Louisiana. Chisholm explained that this right is a federally mandated right to choose from a variety of providers. In Chisholm, the Medicaid patients were restricted to getting services only at a school. And what Chisholm said was that's not enough choice. That's a far different situation from what we have here, where we have only considered unqualified one particular provider. Your Honors, to the extent that you disagree with me, and to the extent that you think 42 U.S.C. 1396 AA23 is interpreted as a right for a lay patient to actually challenge a state agency's decision, Congress has precluded private enforcement of such a right. Under Blessing and Gonzaga, we don't just look at the first three steps that decide whether there's a federal right. Once the existence of the federal right is established, the court next looks to whether Congress explicitly or implicitly precluded a private enforcement of such a right. And this is where the Supreme Court's case in Armstrong becomes important. Armstrong provides the test for determining if Congress implicitly precluded private enforcement. In Armstrong, the court concluded that Congress implicitly precluded private enforcement of a different provision of 42 U.S.C. 1396A. It decided that for two reasons. Number one, it explained that the remedy Congress provided was to withhold funds, was to have the federal DHS withhold funds from a state if it disagreed with the decision. And number two, it decided that that particular provision, 42 U.S.C. 1396AA30, was judicially unadministrable. We contend that those points, then the logic from those points, apply here.
But wasn't Armstrong a right-making? Didn't that involve right-making, something that's traditionally administrative in nature?
It did, Your Honor. So 1396 AA30 involved what Justice Breyer in his concurrence called rate making, and essentially it was a balancing of various factors. Now the interesting thing I think about AA 1369 A30A, is that this court in pediatric specialty care had actually decided that a private right of action existed, and that the language wasn't too ambiguous and judgment-laden to be judicially enforceable. And then Armstrong, in a later case, essentially overrules pediatric specialty. Now, I'll explain, Your Honor, why, while they are two different provisions, the same thinking in Armstrong, or the same logic of Armstrong, actually applies here. So if the right is to challenge a qualification decision, qualification means, it's a term of art, it means something particular in the Medicaid statutes. It's linked to about 50 various reasons that a provider can be considered unqualified. And a lot of these are very judgment-laden reasons that the agency needs to exercise its expertise on. And I'll talk about specifically the one we've mentioned here, which is 42 U.S.C. 1320A-7B6B. And that requires that a provider provide services that don't fall below the recognized standards of health care. Now, what I would suggest is important there to understand is a court would have to figure out what the professionally recognized standards of health care are, how to apply the professionally recognized standards of health care, whether they were applied in the right way to this particular situation. That is just as judgment-laden as the record-setting case.
Well, are the Arkansas courts capable of administering that standard in appeal by the provider?
Judge Colleton, I don't think they are, but that's not the standard they would be administering. The standard they would be administering is whether the state agency acted in an arbitrary and capricious manner or whether its decision was unreasonable. So, in fact, in Justice Breyer's concurrence in the Armstrong case, he says, look, you could eventually have some type of APA appeal if you thought the federal administrative system was wrong. And he said, yes, I understand that then the court would have to be looking into the issues that are about rate paying, but they wouldn't be essentially conducting a de novo review. Essentially, they'd be doing what courts normally do, which is figuring out if the agency sort of got it close enough or what they did made sense.
Can you see any daylight between this case and this Fifth Circuit decision that came out last week?
So, to be candid, the first sense of daylight I hope for is that they got it wrong and you all will get it right. But more seriously, Your Honors, I actually think the Fifth Circuit was very, very careful not only to limit their decision to the specific facts of their case, but also to limit their decision to the concessions that Louisiana made and the bases for the disqualification that Louisiana gave, which is
But as to the standing issue, they addressed that issue.
They did, but what they explained in their standing issue or in whether there's a private right of action is that Louisiana had admitted that or had conceded that there was no problem with their qualifications to provide services. That is not that's not an admission we make. In fact, we have disqualified them for one of the very reasons that are listed in the federal statutes as a reason that makes them unqualified. And I think if you read the logic of the Fifth Circuit case, if Louisiana had a valid reason for calling them unqualified, it would be an exception to 1396AA23. If it's an exception to 1396AA23, they don't have the right to pursue it.
Well, as I read it, the Fifth Circuit specifically said LDHH, the Louisiana Department of Human whatever, argues the individual plaintiffs have not and will not sustain a legal injury, presumably even when the termination becomes effective, because plaintiffs have a right to choose only a qualified provider and Planned Parenthood is not a qualified provider. So that does not seem to be a concession that they're qualified. They make the very argument that you're making here.
So later on, in a number of times, and I'm sorry that I can't cite you to the exact paragraphs, but I feel very confident if we look through the case, a number of times they suggest that Louisiana conceded that Planned Parenthood was qualified to provide the services. I think they actually say it even more than once. It was pretty important to their decision.
Let me ask. I need to ask two questions before you get into your rebuttal time. Two specific questions about the record here. Where in the record do we go to discover and to verify the reason that the Medicaid provider agreement with Planned Parenthood of Arkansas and Eastern Oklahoma was terminated? Where do we go to find that reason? And then second, where do we go in the record to find what was submitted to the district court about the number of remaining qualified providers that would be accessible to the appellees in this case?
Judge Shepard, In terms of the reason for the termination, you go to Appendix 76, which was the second termination letter. And, you know,
What was that number?
Appendix 76. It was the second termination letter. It was the letter that explained, based on the video, evidence, there were significant questions and significant concerns that there was unethical conduct going on. And you'll notice the Seventh and Ninth Circuit cases talk about qualifications, including ethical conduct, potentially conduct violating federal statute. The second question, Your Honor, was I would look in the affidavit of Mark White. There are two affidavits that were submitted to the district court, and I'm sorry I don't have the appendix numbers for you, but they were, I believe, the only or two of three declarations that we submitted.
And what was submitted as to the number or an approximate number of remaining qualified providers?
So I don't want to overspeak here. I believe there were at least 200 providers. That number may be wrong, and I'm not telling you, Your Honor, that every provider provides exactly every service that Planned Parenthood does. But these particular patients who are up on appeal here, they are talking about requiring birth control, annual wellness exams, and STD testing. I believe that's the extent of it, and I think it was 200 providers. The other testimony by declaration was that in addition to those, there were county health clinics, in fact, which two of the three Jane Does had gone to before and gone to for a number of years that would allow them to continue going there.
All right, would you like to reserve your time? Very well, you may. Ms. Sandman, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Jennifer Sandman for the plaintiffs in this case. Federal courts of appeal are unanimous that Medicaid beneficiaries have a private right of action to enforce their claims under the free choice of provider provision. Courts are also unanimous that this provision, free choice of provider, includes the right to choose any qualified provider and that the state may not disqualify a provider for reasons that do not relate to its ability to provide medical services and appropriately bill for them. The Fifth, Seventh, and Ninth Circuits have all spoken to both of these points in unanimous panel decisions. And courts are also unanimous that there is no exhaustion requirement before a plaintiff can bring a case under Section 1983. The question before this court is whether the state can, on the thinnest of records, terminate a provider and escape federal court review of the Medicaid beneficiaries, the individual Doe plaintiffs in this case, escape that review despite the fact that a federal statute exists that every court agrees creates a private right of action to choose any qualified provider. And especially, can the state do this and evade federal review in this manner when the termination is facially insufficient under federal law? And the answer is that they cannot. Now, the state does not want to go into detail about the bases for termination here because they are not only thin, they are impermissible as a matter of federal law. And that is true for three reasons.
Well, before you go into the bases, may I ask you something about the right of action question? If you look at Part 4 of the Armstrong opinion.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which is the part that addresses whether there's a right of action. The first three parts, as you know, are about whether Congress implicitly precluded an equitable claim. The plurality gives three reasons why there's no right of action in that case. One was that the statute was phrased as a directive to the agency charged with approving state Medicaid plans. In other words, the Act says the Secretary shall approve any plan which fulfills the conditions specified in subsection A. The second reason was that the means of enforcing compliance were the Secretary's withholding of funding. And the third was that intended beneficiaries to a contract typically do not have enforceable judicial rights to sue. Now, if that's an accurate statement of the law on right of action, why don't all three of those reasons apply equally here?
Your Honor, I think there are a number of reasons. The first is that Armstrong was a case about the existence of a right of action under the Supremacy Clause and inequity, not under Section 1983.
Well, I know that's what Part 3 of the opinion is about. That's why I was asking about Part 4, which has to do with whether the Medicaid Act provided a cause of action. And the first step in that analysis is to decide whether the Medicaid Act confers a right.
But the reason that I think it's relevant, Your Honor, that there was no Section 1983 action considered in Armstrong is that part of the reason, and the court explicitly recognized this, that there was not a Section 1983 claim was the lack of individual rights granting language. And that language is present here in the free choice of provider provision. Where you have that language present, as well as where you have a provision that, as with this provision, every federal court to consider has deemed to, as Judge Sykes said, fall comfortably within the judiciary's core interpretive competence. Where you have those two factors, the analysis of whether the existence of an alternate remedy of enforcement by CMS precludes an individual cause of action is different. Because in that context, Your Honor, where you have that express rights-granting language, the familiar Gonzaga and Blessing analysis applies. It's not changed by Armstrong, and that standard is met. Here, what Congress has set up is the option. There are two different enforcement mechanisms. There is an enforcement mechanism by which CMS can withhold funds, and there is an enforcement mechanism by which individual plaintiffs can come to federal court and claim that their rights under free choice have been violated, and that's exactly what the individual plaintiffs have done here.
Well, you left out the third, which is the administrative appeal by the provider. So that was my second question I wanted to raise with you. As I understand your interpretation of statute, if a state terminates a provider, say a family practice physician or something, where the state says, we don't think this clinic, this doctor is up to professionally recognized standards, and the family practice physician files an administrative appeal, and the state courts uphold the decision and say, we think the state permissibly said this doctor is not qualified, then the patients of the doctor who want to stick with him or her anyway could file a federal lawsuit and argue that, no, he is in fact qualified. And potentially, as I understand the scheme that you envisioned, the federal court could disagree with the state court and say, even though the state court said the state permissibly said the doctor is not qualified, we, the federal court, think the doctor is qualified, and grant relief to the patients. Now, is that an accurate understanding of your view, and do you think that's really what Congress intended, to have risks of inconsistent decisions like that between state and federal courts?
Your Honor, that is correct, that in my view, there would be a private right of action for those individual plaintiffs to come to federal court. However, that would present a very different case than the case presented here, where not only has there been no administrative or state court determination, but the bases for termination are impermissible under federal law. And I'll get to that in a moment. But before we talk about that, I think it's important to understand
that you don't think the rule would change depending on whether the provider files an administrative appeal, do you? Or is that what you're suggesting, that if the provider does not file an appeal, then the patients can sue, but if the provider appeals, then the patients cannot sue?
No, Your Honor. That is not what I'm suggesting. I think
in either scenario,
the patients...
You said, well, it would be a different case because you didn't appeal.
It would be a different case in the sense that there might be preclusion questions raised, there might be questions raised of what had been determined already in the administrative proceeding. Those cases are not those questions are not presented here.
But
I think this really...
I think Is that a standing issue, or would it be an adjudicative issue?
It would be an adjudicative issue, Your Honor. And here,
well, my question, though, is whether it's a right of action issue, because it goes to whether Congress would have intended that kind of system.
Your Honor, I think in part what the court is alluding to here is the question of whether there's a floodgates concern, that that there could be an administrative appeal, there could be a determination that a provider is actually unqualified, and then that the individual DOE beneficiaries would then come to federal court.
Right.
And ask for a new determination that overlaps those issues. But I think
right.
CMS addressed that very point very effectively in its amicus brief that they submitted in the Fifth Circuit case, Your Honor, when they pointed out that such a case might present easier issues than the issues here. And in the ordinary course, if there is actual evidence, which there is not here, of wrongdoing by a provider, and an actual determination that supports the termination of that provider, and actual claims of wrongdoing by that individual provider, which is also not at issue here, then that might, in the ordinary course, those individual DOE beneficiaries would not have a strong claim in federal court. They would have the right to be in federal court, but they would have a much weaker claim than the DOE beneficiaries do here. And I think it's important to remember here that what's actually happened is a termination where there is no claim of any wrongdoing by PPH. These accusations are not even about PPH. They're about other Planned Parenthood affiliates in other states.
So what happened to this administrative appeal by the Arkansas Planned Parenthood?
Your Honor, PPH, as there are multiple plaintiffs here before the court. Of course, one of those plaintiffs is PPH. PPH had two options for how it would try to vindicate its rights here. It could go through the administrative appeal, or it could come straight to federal court. It did the latter. And I think that it's important to remember that in doing that, PPH also had constitutional claims, which it chose to bring in federal court, as it's permitted to do. And it's also important to remember that there were two separate types of terminations here. There was a for-cause termination, but that before the for-cause termination, the claimed for-cause termination, there was an at-will termination where the state, at the governor's directive, essentially said, we're going to terminate you without claiming that you've done anything wrong. And it's difficult to see what point there would have been to contesting that determination in the administrative process, where the only, I suspect that the only claim would have been the free choice of provider claim, that the state cannot terminate you without a basis. And that's exactly the claim that both PPH and the DOE beneficiaries have brought to this court. And, of course, the DOE beneficiaries had no other place to bring that claim.
Now, the attorney for the state says that the organization recruited these individuals to bring the action or to participate in the action. Is that correct?
Your Honor.
Is that in the record?
Your Honor, I believe what's in the record and what actually happened is that patients discussed with PPH the fact that they wanted to continue providing care there and decided to be plaintiffs in this case, represented by the same counsel as PPH.
What position has the state taken? And maybe I should ask the state this. When did the 30-day period for filing administrative appeal start to run, from the at-will termination or the cause termination?
Your Honor, my understanding is that there were two separate termination events, and those would have two separate 30-day periods. So they happened, I believe, about 2 weeks apart.
So they would have had to, they would have had to file two administrative appeals then, because there are two separate terminations, one at will, one for cause?
I believe that that's correct, Your Honor. And I do want to go back to talking about the basis for the termination here. And not only are these accusations, first, that these accusations are not even about Planned Parenthood of the Heartland, PPH, and that is one of the three reasons that they are inadequate as a matter of federal law, which is part of what makes the issue an appropriate one for this court to consider. And the termination provision that the state relies on here, which is 7B6B, states that the secretary may terminate a provider if that individual or entity has furnished services of a quality which fails to meet professionally recognized standards of health care. But here there is no accusation that PPH, the Planned Parenthood entity providing in Arkansas that holds these Medicaid contracts, provider agreements, has done anything wrong. They're not on the videos. They have never participated in fetal tissue donation. Their conduct is simply not at issue here. Now, the Medicaid, under federal Medicaid law, there is actually a framework in place for the narrow circumstances under which you can sanction an entity based on conduct by another entity. And that is based on specific types of ownership and control that the state does not contend are met here. And that's laid out in our briefing, but it's contained at 42 U.S.C. 3020A 7B8. And CMS agrees in the amicus brief that they filed in the very closely related case in Louisiana that was decided just last week by the Fifth Circuit, affiliation is not enough. They said, thus, a provider's affiliation with a sanctioned entity is not by itself a sufficient basis to exclude the provider from a health care program under these provisions. And that's exactly what the state has attempted to do here. The second reason why these terminations are clearly inadequate under federal law is that there has not been any adequate determination of violation of the standard of health care. And I think it's important.
But the state would respond, but that's only because you didn't file an administrative appeal. That you could have had that determination in an administrative appeal. You had a remedy to
Your
make
Honor,
that determination. So why doesn't that, why isn't sort of the failure to file an administrative appeal sort of an implicit acquiescence in what the state says you did wrong?
Your Honor, there has to be, under federal law, there has to be a, quote, determination, end quote, before the state may terminate you, not after. So here, what they did is they sent a letter, and I think it's important to focus on the contents of this letter because they're quite extraordinary. This is in the appendix at 76. What they said is they cited to the videos, and they said, quote, there is evidence that PPH and or its affiliates are acting in an unethical manner and engaging in what appears to be wrongful conduct. It doesn't say what the conduct is. It doesn't even say who engaged in the conduct. The letter then goes on to ask for such basic information as whether PPH participates in fetal tissue donation, which it does not. Again, CMS agrees this cannot be a determination as required under federal law before a termination can take place, and it's hard to see how it could be.
Well, but isn't all of that better aired and contested in an administrative setting, in the administrative appeal that's that's provided for? It seems to me that this, bringing this as individual claims, is just very ill-suited to the for the task at hand that you want a determination of. Why not? I don't understand why the administrative appeal was ruled out, and this is the route that this matter has taken.
Your Honor, the Doe plaintiffs had no option. I have several answers to that question. One is the Doe plaintiffs had no option for an administrative appeal. Their only option is to come to court, to federal court, and claim violation of their free choice of provider rights, and that's exactly what they've done here. PPH had two options.
I thought it was really not controverted that these Doe plaintiffs are acting here in consultation with Planned Parenthood, that they didn't just come in as independent actors, but that this all came about as a result of some consultation with PPH, if not actual recruitment, as the state contends.
Your Honor, I don't think that question has any bearing on the fact that the Doe plaintiffs have their own federal rights that they are entitled to vindicate in federal court, as the Seventh Circuit recognized, as the Fifth Circuit recognized, as the Ninth Circuit recognized. Now here, PPH did have the option to go through the administrative appeal, or it had the option to come straight to federal court, and what it did is go to federal court. And as I noted before, PPH had constitutional claims that it also brought as part of its case in federal court, and had it gone through the administrative process, that process would have had to include an appeal from the at-will termination, which was also, in effect, at the same time, it actually preceded the for-cause termination. So here, the Fifth Circuit agrees it did not matter that the provider in that case did not go through the administrative appeal, and I think the reason for that is, number one, there's no exhaustion requirement even for PPH, and number two, the Doe plaintiffs had no remedy to exhaust. There's no requirement that they wait for PPH to go through the administrative court, or that their rights are in any way limited by the fact that PPH did not do that. Now, I'm aware that my time is very short, and I want to leave the court with a few final thoughts.
Let me ask one final question. Do you agree that the services that are in question here, the medical services, are birth control, annual wellness, and STD testing? That's the range of services that's in question.
Those are the primary services at issue, correct? You know, at the end of the day, really, defendant is suggesting that it can disqualify any Medicaid provider by simply labeling them as engaging in misconduct when the bases for termination on their face do not comply with federal law, when the accusation is not even about that particular provider, and where the supposed determination that they make is a letter that doesn't say what anyone did or who did it or what the accusations are based on, and that once they label a provider in that way, the individual plaintiff beneficiaries have no further free choice of provider rights. That is simply not the law. As the Fifth, Seventh, and Ninth Circuits have all recognized, that would make the free choice of provider protections meaningless. It would eviscerate them. And I think it's important to note here that the defendant is trying to make this case heavily turn on the fact that this is a claimed individual termination of a Medicaid provider. And that's how they try to distinguish Judge Sykes' persuasive analysis in the Seventh Circuit, as well as Batlock coming out of the Ninth Circuit, on the theory that those cases were different because they did not involve a determination that a particular provider was unqualified. But that really vastly overstates and misstates what has happened here. There has been no actual determination of wrongdoing by PPH. They don't claim that there has. And the case, I think it's important to note that this case would essentially be no different if the Arkansas legislature, instead of the executive, had responded to the videos by passing a law saying Planned Parenthood, PPAEO, Planned Parenthood Arkansas, and Eastern Oklahoma cannot be a Medicaid provider because of the videos, because they're a Planned Parenthood entity. And that hypothetical case, is really no different from this, because that's exactly what the executive did here. They didn't claim that PPH as a provider did anything wrong. And that case really would be on all fours with Batlock and Judge Sykes' analysis in the Indiana case.
Very well. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Radofsky, I think you have a little time remaining for rebuttal, so we'll hear from you.
Judge, thank you. May it please the court. Judge Shepard, you asked where in the record the Planned Parenthood has went out and recruited plaintiffs. You can find that at Appendix 439, and that's in their own briefing. They admit that. What they say is that they took diligent efforts to go out and identify plaintiffs, and they couldn't find a lot, but they managed to find these three.
Let's start the clock, Ms. Dahm.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Judge Malloy, on Planned Parenthood v. Gulf Coast, Fifth Circuit case that just recently came out, the case says, we recognize initially that LDHH does not even attempt to articulate how its grounds for termination relate to PPGC's qualifications. That failure is exacerbated by the fact that LDHH has separately conceded that PPGC is competent to provide the relevant medical services. So that's where I would point to. And there are other similar phrases in that decision, but that's where I would point to, that this case is, on this record, is very different. And Judge Colleton, your question about inconsistent results to my opposing counsel, I would go one further with you, or hopefully you would go one further with me. It's not just a potential inconsistent result between state courts and federal courts. In your hypothetical, after the state courts rule, if the federal agency who's charged with administering the statute then decided, well, maybe the state was wrong, and it decided to consult with the state agency and figure out what the state agency's bases were for termination, and ultimately the federal agency who's charged with overseeing the state agency agreed with the state agency, you'd then have the federal court who is both disagreeing with a state court and with the federal DHS. So the chance for inconsistent results in a case like this are even greater than your question to my opposing counsel suggests.
Well, I don't know how that helps you, because what you're saying is, even under your theory of the case, where you either can go through administrative remedy where the state court comes to one result and the federal and it could be the federal agencies decides to pull your funding, and I don't know the entire scheme, but presumably you would then have a right to go to federal court to say the agency was wrong, and the federal court can say, well, yeah, the agency's right. So I don't know how that helps you, because under your theory, it doesn't solve the problem that Judge Gallatin raised.
Judge Malloy,
results.
It's a very fair point. What I would argue is there's much less of a chance of inconsistent results with the one state appeal, which, quite frankly, as a practical matter, would happen first in these cases. And then if the state courts decided, yes, this provider should be out, with then potentially the agency ultimately deciding it wants to withhold funds. There is a chance of some inconsistent results, but it's not the chance of a federal court coming in and saying both the state court and the federal agency charged with administering this statute is wrong. There's a chance of much greater inconsistency in the second option, in allowing a patient to collaterally attack a decision like this. And I don't want to leave without suggesting that this court should also, truly on this record, also concentrate on irreparable harm here. We lay out in our brief why there is really no irreparable harm to these three patients, two of which have been to lots of providers and certainly the county health clinic for years before they came to Planned Parenthood. And really their only argument is that Planned Parenthood has a 15-minute or 30-minute less wait time and maybe a week-long less lead time in making appointments. That's not the type of great and harm that constitutes irreparable harm under this circuit's precedence. And I know my time has expired, but I'll just leave the court with one thought, which is, it's not in the record, but you can take judicial notice of this. Between the time that the limited injunction was granted and now, Planned Parenthood has continued to serve all of these patients without charging them. Now, they've taken that
on
themselves.
Well, if it's outside the record, I think you've said enough. We'll submit the case on the arguments presented. Thank you both for your arguments, and the court will file an opinion in due course.